Welcome to a special edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, where we will be bringing you a compilation of some of our favorite conversations that took place on the podcast over the past year. This year, Hank has brought you out of the studio and into his study for the Hank Unplugged podcast. We hope that you enjoy listening to the podcast as much as we do. The Hank Unplugged podcast was started in order to range farther and dive deeper into both perennial and contemporary issues of interest to thinking Christians with some of the most interesting and inspirational people in the world, and it has far exceeded our expectations. In this edition of Hank Unplugged, we will revisit some moments from the past year. To begin, we will bring you to a conversation from the episode with Mary Eberstadt and a discussion dealing with a new secularist religion of our time and issues we're facing due to the sexual revolution.
I'm looking forward to the conversation. You're one of my favorite guests on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. I think the work that you did, and It's Dangerous to Believe, is one of the great contributions to Western civilization. That's a big platitude, but what I mean by that is you're opening people's eyes to two things, I think. One is something that's squarely in the blind spot of the West, and that is the mass genocide of Christians in the East. And then there's a change, as it were, taking place in Western civilization where Christian ideologies are being replaced by a new kind of fanatical religious ideology. It's not as though we're going to materialism or secularism at its base, but we're going to a new ideology that has a lot to do with the sexual revolution.
Yes, absolutely, Hank. There's so much going on out there, but I think what's really new and unexpected is this development of what I call a secularist religion. Now, we have seen secularist religions or secular ideologies that operate like religion before. We saw this most notably in the case of communism, which eventually fell, at least as an idea that could claim the loyalties of millions of people. Of course, it's still in force in some places, but it doesn't have that sort of quasi-religious claim to people's loyalty. Well, what we're seeing now, and I think completely unexpected, but for the past 50 years, since the invention of the birth control pill specifically, which gave rise to the sexual revolution, we are seeing a secularist religion that is developing and more sophisticated year by year, that is grounded in theology about the sexual revolution. Now, I don't think religious believers saw this coming. I think we're all acquainted with the kind of ferocity and prejudice that Christian expression can be greeted with in the public square these days. I think we can think of many examples. We can get into some of them if you like. But as to where this hostility is coming from, I think we have to understand this new rival faith to Christianity. The people who believe that the sexual revolution is paramount and that sexual expression is the most morally protected form of expression are absolutists about their beliefs. And their beliefs are, of course, diametrically opposed to what conventional, traditional Christian teaching is and always has been. So that's the conflict. That's what's at the root of the conflict that we see in these Supreme Court cases about religious expression. That's what's at the root of not wanting, say, a football coach to drop to his knees at the end of a game. In case after case, we're seeing the sort of bubbles on the surface, and I don't mean to make light of that, of a much deeper conflict, and it's a conflict between people who believe in the good book, that is traditional Judeo-Christianity, and people who believe in the figurative book that's being written about belief in the sexual revolution.
So if you believe in this figurative book, there are some maxims, and those maxims include if you are against abortion, you are therefore anti-female. If you oppose same-sex marriage, therefore you hate people attracted to same sex. If you are against gender fluidity, then you are against those who want that open freedom of expression. So this kind of puts Christians in a box. Once you turn the tables in this way, and if people do not understand that this is illogical, they immediately think, well, anti-abortion? Well, no wonder, you're a bigot. And then there comes this great tidal wave of having to unseat Christianity because it is the main force for evil in Western civilization. So it's no longer seen as that which gave rise to jurisprudence, that which gave rise to science, that which gave rise to the arts, etc., but it's seen as that which is the ultimate enemy. In fact, an enemy that is far greater than Islam, because Islam is seen, by contrast, to be a religion of peace and tolerance.
Yes. When I say that there is a secularist religion that's developed in the Western world, certainly I'm not saying that it's always logically consistent. I think those examples that you gave are spot on. So for instance, let's talk for a minute about abortion. Pro-life advocates get smeared routinely with this label of being anti-woman. It's ridiculous. If you look at the debate, who is really standing for women here? In the case of abortion, we have something going on called gendercide, and it's happening around the world. Girl fetuses are aborted at much higher rates than male fetuses, especially in societies that prize, depend on having a son. So who is standing up for women? Is it the people who are saying the more abortion, the better? Or is it the people who are saying there is something immoral going on here? And that's just one example of the sort of illogic. You pointed out some other very good ones that riddles this secularist religion. Of course, it's not true that in virtue of opposing same-sex marriage, Christians oppose people with various erotic leanings one way or the other. Of course, it's not true that they're haters. But these very harmful words, hater and bigot, have been introduced by believers in the new secularist faith in order to shut down Christian argument. People don't want to have a discussion about these things if they are adherents of the Church of the Sexual Revolution. I think they know that 2,000 years of Christian thinking has probably given people some pretty good arguments on the Christian side, and they don't want to deal with that. And that's where these labels are coming from. They are used to stop debate and stop discussion in what the other side fears would be a losing conversation for them.
You sort of mentioned the moniker thinking. I mean, perhaps that's the problem. I mean, people aren't thinking anymore. I mean, we're being bombarded with advertisement. We see incredible chaos around the world, and then we go to an advertisement. We never really think, and I think so often that's the problem. If you look at what's going on in the campus craziness around the world, you have people who don't think, they don't actually engage the arguments. They simply have a particular bias. They fly with the bias instead of having an interchange of ideas or real dialogue.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's always human nature, Hank, to want to take the easy way out. We also have to keep in mind that, of course, the internet inflames everything and everybody. But that said, what there's very little awareness of these days is the harm that's being inflicted on fellow citizens, fellow neighbors, fellow family members by these labels of hater and bigot, where often all that is meant is that you follow the teachings of Jesus Christ. And this is really something new in American history. One way I think of it is that we used to be a society that feared God, and now we are a society where people jeer God and feel morally purposeful when they do that. So this is a real civilizational change. We have to be aware of it, I think. And we have to understand that what Christians today are up against in the Western world is not just some polite disagreement with people who have moved past Christianity. No, what they're up against is a real mortal struggle with the theology of the sexual revolution, because people who believe in that theology think and understand that Christianity is the biggest living threat.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about this a little bit, because in many ways, Christians are going to be the people that have to pick up the pieces in the end. Transgenderism, a classic case in point. You have a particular narrative that is being communicated in classrooms. I mean, talking about kids that are 6, 7, 8 years old who are being told that perhaps they're a girl trapped in a boy's body or a boy trapped in a girl's body. And therefore, they really don't know what their gender identity is. They'll probably find that out later on. Or sometimes they're told, you know, if you feel like you're a girl trapped in a boy's body, you ought to be taking some kind of drug. You ought to start looking into doing something about the body that you have. And then that body, at a very early age, and there's some chilling examples of this, starts to be tampered with. And even though you can tamper with it in an artificial, superficial way, ultimately, you can't change biology on a cellular level. So all of that is simply to say, Mary, I mean, I think what's going on here is we're sowing to the wind, we're going to reap the whirlwind. And if, in fact, Christians understand what's going on, we can be there to pick up the pieces, because the social experiment, I think, is devastating for people created in the Imago Dei, the image and likeness of God.
Absolutely, Hank. And this is another side of the whole discussion that people aren't grasping. That is that in any other context, if what were being defended were not somehow the sexual revolution, the idea that we are all sexually malleable in all dimensions, and that we get to call the shots about what we do with our bodies. If it were about anything but that, and I were to say to you, Hank, I've just found out that there are medical experiments being run on children, you know, in a very untoward way, giving them drugs, changing basic things about them, surgery, which some people would call mutilation. If I were to say those things, in any other context but the sexual revolution, people would say, that's terrible. We can't have that. But somehow when it comes to the terrible human fallout of the revolution, people who want to defend it at all costs are blind to the damage that's being done out there. And I think part of our jobs as people who do not believe that theology is to bring that damage to the attention of people, even understanding that they have deep reasons for not wanting to see the damage. I'll give you another example. In the name of the sexual revolution and its growing theology, there is more and more commercial surrogacy, you know, meaning people who hire themselves out very often in the third world and are paid very often by couples for reasons of the sexual revolution, to have children. Now, this is another experiment that is probably not going to look so good in the rearview mirror of history. And there's a lot more out there that social science has documented. Of course, we know about the damages to kids from broken homes. And in saying that, I'm not pointing a finger at anyone. I mean, Christians are always accused of doing that. That's not the case. But we all know the kinds of educational outcomes, behavioral outcomes, et cetera, and the risks that are raised in particularly homes without a dad. So there is a lot that has happened on account of the sexual revolution that is not to the credit of the revolution. And it should be fair game to insist on pointing that out.
Next up, Hank is joined by Hall of Fame Bible Answer Man broadcast guest, Joe Dallas, to discuss the rising acceptance of gender fluidity.
You and I have been talking about this for almost 30 years, and I suppose what we were talking about 20 years ago or 10 years ago seemed almost, well, it seems sensationalistic, talking about what was going to happen, what were the natural steps of decline in a civilization that starts down this road, starts down the road of the sexual revolution, no-fault divorce, and then you have the characters on television. First, you start laughing at sitcoms that are featuring gay couples or gay individuals interacting, so it becomes humorous. And pretty soon, we are all the way to where we are right now, gender fluidity, transgenderism, and this now is set up a situation where biology does not determine gender, but now it's a function of feeling. So we have come a long way, and I suppose in some sense, we need to keep talking about where this will all lead if, in fact, Christians don't learn how to think Christianly, don't learn how to think critically, don't learn how to be salt and light in a culture that is changing dramatically. And this is no longer year by year, it's month by month.
Honestly, Hank, 25 years ago, you and I, when we discussed this, sounded like alarmists. Today, we sound more like historians. We're not only talking about what has come to pass, but what has been in place now for years. And you bringing up the transgender issue, I think is critical because in discussing this decades ago, who would have believed us? And yet here we are. Now, I think what we are seeing in the broader sense is very, very frightening, and it goes beyond sexual sin. Today, man is taking it on himself to usurp God's power. We are reserving for ourselves the prerogative to speak things into existence. If I say I'm a woman, I am a woman. And not only am I entitled to believe what I say, you must comply with what I say. I must be able to use the bathroom of my choice. I must have you refer to me as I wish to be referred to. If I say I'm a woman, I am a woman. If I say I'm both male and female, I am both male and female. If I say you are a bigot, you are a bigot. If I say you don't have spiritual convictions, you have prejudice, you have prejudice. If I said it, it must be so. This is man taking it on himself to speak into existence what he wishes. And of course, that is a prerogative that is only reserved for God. But we have decided that we will override what God has created. And thereby, we have women saying no to their creator and saying yes to their passions. I am not a woman. I am a man because I said so. And never mind the fact that my DNA will never testify to that. Never mind the fact that I can never literally become a male. I will reconfigure my body. I will adopt a new identity. And I will sue you if you will not be willing to comply with my demand that you refer to me as I wish to be referred to. So this is way, way beyond the quest for tolerance of different viewpoints and diversity and multiculturalism. This is a demand for a monolithic viewpoint of human sexuality driven by the demand for man to be able to speak into existence what he wishes, regardless of what his creator has already designed. Serious business.
It is serious business. You know, I like to get from you is sort of a perspective on maybe two different sides of the coin. On the one hand, you talk about, well, if you do not comply, we'll sue you. If you do not comply, you're going to lose your position. If you do not comply, we're going to put the financial burden on you such that you're going to finally fall in line with what the narrative is. That's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin for me is to hear these stories, Joe, of people. I mean, real people created in the image and likeness of God that have gone down the transgender path, and they've had the hormone treatments and the reconstructive surgery and all these kinds of things, you hear the horror stories of these people recognizing, wow, I did all of this, and all people treat me as now is a freak. I was listening to a story the other day. It was a very touching story of a man who decided he was actually a woman. And so he went through all the reconstructive surgery. He listened to the narrative. And this was a very, very large man. And when he'd go out in public, dressed as a woman with the reconstructive surgery, the children would look at him and they would sort of laugh, sort of do what children do, speak extemporaneously and say things. And this person eventually didn't even want to leave home because he felt so conspicuous and regretted so much making the decision. But once you start down the path of surgical reconstruction, you don't have the same liberty that you had when you made the change. I mean, you didn't do anything to alter your body. These people are altering their physical makeup.
Hank, I've thought of this more times than I can tell you. When I repented, it was a cakewalk next to what someone goes through when they realize that after sex change surgery, they have made a mistake. Now, the good news is, even then, people do walk away and live godly and healthy lives. There's a whole website set up called Sex Change Regret, which covers testimonials of people who have gone that route and learned to live according to the gender God assigned to them. Yes, there are permanent prices to be paid in many cases, but still they are able to do it and find their life much more abundant than it was when they were trying to improve what God had already determined that did not need improving. But the point is, yes, there is a terrible price to pay for trying to alter your body to match what I believe is a distortion. And I remember, about 3 years ago, a horrible story about a young man who had Christian parents and demanded that he be allowed to live as a transgender, therefore as a woman. And his parents would not allow him, because he was a teen, to have sex change surgery or wear different clothing. And then he finally, when he became an adult, left home and did begin living as the opposite sex and began the procedure of sex reassignment, and then reached a point of absolute despair. And in his suicide note, before he stepped in front of a train, he said, "I will never be happy as a male or as a female. There is no life left for me." That is a desperate, horrible, devastating example of the foolishness of this quest for a better life through altering what really cannot be altered. Now, we do have to extend real empathy and sympathy and compassion to people who feel so strongly that they are in the wrong body that they would try to do such a thing, because this is an extraordinary thing they attempt to do. And I think we must feel a real compassion for someone who is so deeply convinced they are trapped in the wrong body. But what we must do is move alongside them in love and encourage them to accept what God created them to be, rather than trying to change the unchangeable and figure out why it is they are so dissatisfied with the body and with the sex that God assigned them. And consider that to be the problem which needs resolution, rather than the body being the problem which needs resolution. I think there's our challenge as a church.
Well, that challenge is particularly difficult for you as an individual. And again, if you can personalize it a little bit, I mean, you are going against the grain. You're dealing with anthropology. You're dealing with human sexuality. And you are not following the politically correct narrative. I mean, there's got to be some angst in your life on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you've built a reputation. All of that can be stripped from you very, very quickly because of what you're saying and doing. Though what you're saying and doing is built out of a heart of love, the narrative is just against you.
Yeah, Hank, I have to be careful. Every so often, I really start just thinking in a sort of everybody hates me, nobody likes me, let's eat worms kind of a mentality, like, oh, I am so sick of being unpopular. But it's not, I'd be a real jerk to feel sorry for myself, even though sometimes I do, because God has been so good to me, and he gave me a wife, and out of our union, life has come. And if I may veer off just a bit, I believe one of the reasons Satan so empowers these movements to silence Christians on these issues is because what God intended gives life. The male-female union produces life, not just the life of the offspring, although that would be enough to celebrate, but also life for both partners. And I think that if I hated humanity as Satan does, I would do everything I could to prevent people from finding that life. But I do find that what this has done for me in the positive sense, Hank, is it gets me a little more in touch with what I think Christians have more traditionally felt. We American Christians have had it awfully easy, really. We've been largely, as a church, in sync with our culture for decades and decades and decades and decades. Only recently have we begun to feel what believers have traditionally felt, that they are at odds with our culture on critical issues, and that they are often misunderstood, often hated, often persecuted. And this has at least given me a little more of a sense of, hey, I am a temporal citizen of the United States, and I want to be a good one. I want to vote wisely. I want to be part of the process. But this is not my home. And I'm an eternal citizen of the kingdom of God. And it does, at least in that sense, remind me of who I really belong to. But to be candid with you, just this last weekend, my wife and I both spoke at a Christian conference in San Diego. The hotel we spoke at was picketed by activists. They put flyers under the doors of the guests saying how this terrible Hilton hotel was housing these homophobes and it shouldn't be allowed. And they made statements about us that we were putting teenagers through shock treatment to make them heterosexual and that we were causing people to hate homosexuals. And it was disheartening to drive up to the church and have people shouting obscenities at us and making accusations that were just ludicrous. It does get ticked. There's no way for it not to. But I think we have to recognize being a steward of truth is a commission that we cannot shy away from. Otherwise, we are not really living the truth. God did not just call us to know the truth, although we must. He didn't even just call us to be conformed to the truth, although we must. He called us to express the truth. As stewards of truth, we have to remember we are expressing truth in a world which is largely opposed to it. And there's nothing like these sexual issues we're talking about to remind you of that, Hank.
In the next clip, Hank is joined by Dr. Frank Beckwith to discuss what many believe to be the watershed issue of our time. Abortion.
Way back in 1993, and this was the occasion for me to really get to know Frank Beckwith, he wrote a book called Politically Correct Death, Answering the Arguments for Abortion Rights. And I remember back in those years, I would go through that book and then through it again and then through it again. I dog-eared that book. I quoted from that book. That book was transformational because in that book, I started understanding how significant the life issue really is. Francis Schaeffer once said that this would be the watershed issue of our epoch of time, and he was certainly right about that. I'm talking to Frank as well because both of us made some significant changes in our lives, but we are both deeply committed to the concept of mere Christianity. Frank, I am so delighted to catch up with you. It's been a long time. We haven't talked. Got a letter from you when I converted to Orthodoxy, and it was very, very calming to me. You said, I've been through this. If you want to talk, let's have a conversation.
Well, it's great to be on, Hank. I can testify that I remember when you interviewed me for Politically Correct Death, and we were in the studio together, and I couldn't believe the color coordination that was in the text from notes you had taken and things you wanted to memorize. So I can testify you did, you know, if it were a record album, we could say you bled it white, right?
Exactly. I mean, I love that book. And of course, you've written many books on the life issue. I mean, this is one of the issues that is a passion for you. Maybe we should start out by talking about this rudimentary issue. Here we live in an age of technology. When you wrote that book, we didn't have the kind of technology that we have today. I mean, people can now examine the evidence and know that a preborn child can actually see the face of a mother and have the cognitive awareness of whether that face is upside down or right side up. So we have great strides in technology, but the abortion issue isn't going away.
Yeah, it's really the watershed issue of our age. I mean, there are many other issues that I think one can link to the abortion issue because they all deal with, to a certain extent, the question of who and what we are and whether we can know it. And the abortion issue raises even a deeper question, and that is what sort of obligations that do we have to those that are more vulnerable than us that we bring into existence? I mean, there's something godlike in the fact that human beings can actually, with God, participate in bringing other human beings into existence. And the idea that we can simply destroy those human beings as a matter of will without any justification is abhorrent. And it was that issue really profoundly affected my own sort of development as a Christian in the early 1980s. I was considered myself moderately pro-choice around 1984 or so when I was in graduate school, and one of my fellow graduate students, who believe it or not was an atheist, shot down my pro-choice arguments, and it surprised me how badly I was reasoning. And the other thing that was ironic about it is it was an unbeliever that actually was the one that helped change my mind. But as I began thinking more deeply about the issue, I began to see how it is connected to not only, you know, a sort of obligation we have just to not harm others, but the obligation we have for those that we actually are responsible for bringing into existence, and what that tells us about just ethics in general. Many of the ways in which people reason about this issue always emphasize the struggle and the challenges that a pregnant woman may have. But if you think about it, the idea that our ethics should be driven solely by what we perceive as consequences for ourselves is, I think, ultimately undermining the kind of obligations that do require us to, in fact, move above and beyond what our desires are. I mean, this is what it means to be human.
You know, I think about the experiences I've had, Frank. You know, as you know, I have 12 children. And watching children being birthed is one of the greatest wonders imaginable. To see one human being come out of another human being is truly a miracle. I always watched it without any sense of the blood or the gore that some people get turned off by. It was always a beautiful mystery that was unfolding before my eyes. And, you know, the more you see births take place, the more you know about what happens before a baby is born, the more passion you have about subjects like this.
Yeah, and the today, as you mentioned earlier, the technology, when we were able to peer into the womb and see things that even people 25, 30 years ago would have never thought imaginable. And yet, the idea that abortion is permissible still persists. And I think it has a lot to do with what people, how people think of their own nature as human persons. Usually, when we think about human beings, we think about usually ordinary adult human beings, and those are individuals that have consciousness, are able to reflect on life. And a lot of people, some philosophers will say, well, the unborn aren't like that, so therefore they're not truly persons. And I think it's a mistaken view of what we are. We're not at any one point of our existence wholly or completely perfected. I mean, and so if you think about the human being not as at any one point being complete, you can see that what the unborn human being is just simply one of us at an earlier stage of development, and that the maturation of that being is in fact a movement towards its perfection, but it still is what it is. It doesn't become anything different. It's just simply, in a way, it's a kind of unfolding, right, of the majesty of the image of God that we reflect. And yet, you know, it still persists. The good thing is that I think that in terms of the general culture, people are much more inclined to the pro-life position than they were maybe 25, 30 years ago. And I think the technological advances, I think, have made that possible.
What about the anthropological problems that persist, though? I mean, if you look today at things that concern you, like gender fluidity or same-sex sexuality, all of these things are part and parcel of a misunderstanding or a misappreciation of the Imago Dei, the image of God in humanity, and how we were created to be by an infinite, ineffable God who is knowable through His graces.
I think you're right. I mean, it's of the same kind of thinking, and let me explain what I mean by that. People today have a kind of a dualist view of the human person. Now, I want to be careful here because as Christians, we believe that in fact we have souls, and those souls can exist apart from our bodies. So I do believe that as Christians, we accept a kind of dualism in the sense that we believe that there's an immaterial aspect of our nature that does survive death. However, another important aspect of the Christian worldview is that we're going to be resurrected. Why? Because we are embodied souls by nature. We're not simply souls that happen to be tagged onto a body. Well, what does it have to do with abortion and gender issues? Well, insofar as those that want to sort of separate the intellectual part of the person from the physical part of the person can actually say things like, well, I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body. The assumption is that there is a physical kind of, that the human body is a kind of instrument of the mind and is not the real self, but the real self is purely the psychological. And tie that to the abortion issue, because the early fetus and embryo isn't psychologically mature, the assumption is it's not truly a person. So you have there's similar reasoning there. And I think the thing that has to be, I think, argued for is that human beings are not simply, our psychological selves. That is certainly an important aspect of us. It's the way we exercise our will. It's the way in which we think. But if we're ultimately, though, embodied, think about it. Even when we think, we have to actually perceive the world that's out there. We are beings that eat and drink and feel and love with our bodies. This is what we are. And so this is why as Christians, we have to, I think, remember what the scriptures teach, and then what the tradition teaches, namely that we're not simply this kind of Cartesian view of a thinking thing that happens to be attached to some bit of matter, that we are ensouled, and that that what we are as human beings is something that is complex, but it's also reflects the way in which God has made us, and He made us not simply as minds attached to bodies, but in fact embodied souls.
Why does God allow evil? In the upcoming clip, this perennially perplexing problem is discussed with professor and preeminent Christian Research Journal contributor, Clay Jones.
You know what I'm always wondering when I read your articles or I look at your new book? I wonder, there's got to be some reason why you zeroed in on one of the most significant questions that we could ever ask as human beings. Why does God allow evil?
Well, you know, I have to go back. It was 1981, and I was a young pastor at a church, and I started, the Lord, as I was teaching, for some reason, I began to understand the glory that awaits us in heaven forever. That became the major study of my life. It was just absolutely thrilling to me, and the thing I like to teach on the most, after actually several years of that, I then all of a sudden thought, you know, where did we come from? I see where we're going. I see what God's doing for our eternity. Where did we come from? And so then I decided to study the depths of human sinfulness, our lost condition without Christ. And when I put those two together, frankly, and I realize some people are going to think this is crazy talk, but the problem of evil just didn't seem like much of a problem anymore. And by the way, I always like to quote D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, the famous expositor of Westminster Chapel. He said, most of our troubles are due to the fact that we're guilty of a double failure. He says, we fail on the one hand to realize the depth of sin, and on the other hand, we fail to realize the greatness and hidden glory of our salvation. You know, he says, most of our troubles, and I think that's exactly right. I think when it comes to the problem of evil, I think that's right. But I think it's also true just regarding the entire Christian life. You need to understand the depths of human sinfulness, and you need to understand the glory that He's taking us into forever. And I think that once I began to really seriously come to grips with these issues, the problem of evil just largely went away. And I thought, then somebody said, you ought to write a book. And I went, okay. And that was 23 years ago. I didn't know it would take 23 years. But.
Well, you know what's interesting to me is I've read a lot of your articles, familiar with your work, and have appreciated you for a long period of time, albeit from a distance. But I read an article that you wrote for the Christian Research Journal, and it just somehow or other intoxicated me. I thought, this is one of the best articles I've ever read in my life. It was the article that you wrote, Why Did God Let That Child Die? And what I loved about that article is you point out that we don't know God's reason with respect to any particular child, but we can answer pretty well why God allows children to die in general. And what I loved about the article is you had a sequence of questions that you ask someone who is asking about a particular person that gets them to see why it would be a cartoonish world.
Right.
If, in fact, there were not consequences for behavior.
That's right. I tell my students, by the way, whenever anybody says, whoever you're arguing with, a skeptic, an atheist, whatever brand of person that's asked this kind of question and says, because it's always specific. Why did God let Megan die at 7 years old of leukemia? Why did He let Braden die, you know, get hit by a car while he was skateboarding? And if you generalize it out and you begin to say, well, it's not just Megan, right? And you don't think any child should die of cancer, do you? And they go, well, no. And then, well, you don't think they should die of any other disease, do you? And they always, Hank, I've said this to a lot of people, and they always go, no, of course children shouldn't die of other diseases. Well, you don't think they ought to be killed in car accidents. Of course God shouldn't let them get killed in car accidents. By the time you're done, and that's what I do in the article you're talking about, by the time you're done, then I finally say, so to what age do you think children should be indestructible? And, of course, that's patently You know, I mean, that doesn't work. Then you really do have a cartoon world. How does he make children indestructible? And I don't think I put this in the article because I have to qualify it, but I want to just say right now, I oppose all forms of child abuse. There, I said it. But think about an indestructible two-year-old. You could throw that child across the room, and he's coming back at you because he's indestructible, and you're not. And this also goes for animals. When people, you know, as you know, Hank, one of the famous questions is, you know, why did God let a particular fawn slowly die of burns in the forest? Well, it's not just that fawn, right? And you just take it out. It's because they don't care about one fawn. They're saying, why does God let fawns? It's not just fawns. You don't think adult deer should die in forest fires, do you? And by the time you're done, you're saying, well, when do you ever let animals be hurt? And it does, anyway, I think it's, I think when people begin to see that, I think it's really helpful.
Yeah, and if there are no consequences for actions, the world would be make-believe. It wouldn't be a real world, and you make that discernible with many different examples. I mean, a rubber knife where, I think in the article, you have one kid stabbing another kid with a knife and it turns to rubber, or you're playing marbles on the freeway. In other words, you're violating natural law. But this also relates to the whole idea of God having to interfere with our free will.
Yeah, that's. I think that's, you know, I finally, and one of the things that, Hank, you and I agree on, and that is I always tell people, you know what, I got to just say at the outset, you can hold to Arminian prevenient grace, or you can hold to Calvinist election, and the theodicy I present works. But one thing you can't hold to for the theodicy that I present to work is determinism, that God has determined our every thought and deed so that we can never do other than we do. Because I simply don't think you can answer the problem of evil if you say that God determined our every thought and deed. That's why R.C. Sproul said, I do not know the solution to the problem of evil, and nor do I know anyone else who does. Because if God determines our every thought and deed, then the guy who tortures to death a little girl next door couldn't have not tortured that little girl to death because God determined that he would do all the terrible things that he does. Well, you can't make sense of the world. And so now back to the free will thing you mentioned. Yes, I think it comes down to free will. I don't think the universe makes sense if you're going to say God determines our every thought and deed. He actually did the greater thing of creating us as beings that have free will. And as you know, Hank, you can't create a being with free will and not let them use it wrongly. That's as logical as it gets.
You know, when you're talking, it brings me back to being a young kid, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years of age. During those years, I remember deterministic sermons and making a decision in my own young mind at that time, if God creates people who are doomed from the womb to certain destruction, if my will plays no part in it whatsoever, I don't know that I want to be a Christian. And I think that was, I mean, there are a lot of things we can look back at. Ultimately, we try to rationalize God out of existence. But that was a God I did not want to have any part of.
William Lane Craig uses the analogy. It's like, you know, God sets up army men and has them fight. And then one side, you know, the side of his choosing goes to hell forever. Because if in a deterministic universe, that's really what you end up having. I think that's true. And I realize a lot of determinists are offended at that. And they'll say, well, that's a very pejorative statement. No, it's the actual logical outcome of your view. If you're going to say that God determines everything, well, you end up with like Gordon Clark, who said, God's the cause of sin. Of course God's the cause of sin. God's the cause of everything. Even John Frame says that God causes sin. And Christianity becomes, well, as you know, Hank, it ends up in contradiction. And what I think they ought to do is instead of going, okay, let's be humble, once their view leads them to the point where they have to take away human responsibility and say, well, no, there still has to be human responsibility. You say, well, how does that work if God causes everything? And they go, well, let's be humble. I think they ought to insert humility earlier in their system.
You know what's kind of interesting to me is if indeed God is the author of evil. How do you separate then God from being evil himself? I mean, that's the question I think that people who have that view ultimately have to grapple with.
Oh, I think that's true, especially because, as you know, there are a lot of determinists who actually believe, take it so far as to say that God himself doesn't have libertarian free will. And if you say God himself doesn't have libertarian free will, in other words, he can't even himself do anything other than he does. He has to always do what he does. Well, that means that Auschwitz necessarily issued from God's character. Look out, folks, that God couldn't not, listen to these words are important, God couldn't not have Auschwitz occur. That's scary.
So here's probably something I want to discuss with you. I don't know I've ever discussed this with anyone, certainly in a public forum, but what do you do with people in the Christian world that hold that position of theistic fatalism? Are you still able to be collegial? You mentioned R.C. Sproul. I love R.C. He's been a friend of mine for years. Are you still able to get along with those? Or is this sort of an acid test of orthodoxy?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I have colleagues that I work with, of course, that hold to determinism in our university, and we have obviously a lot of libertarians in our university too, like William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland and Scott Ray. They're all libertarians. Gary DeWeese, all of them libertarians. But we also have some determinists, and I wouldn't go so far as to say they're not Christians, but I would say that they're profoundly mistaken on this issue. And I, you know, we get along. I don't go out and just, you know, attack them and challenge them, but they know what I believe. And if I get the opportunity, I'll certainly discuss it with them. But I don't. But, you know, one of the things, by the way, that I'm coming to the conclusion, Hank, and this is really interesting to me, is why people want determinism to be true. And I've been asking people this kind of question because I argue this. You know, we have students come in that are determinists, and they start taking my class, and then we have online forums. And I'll say, so let me ask you something. If determinism is true, you could spend, and I asked a student this just recently, I said, if determinism is true, then you could spend 4 hours last night looking at porn, and when you're done, you can say, well, you know what? For some reason, God determined that I would do that. And the guy said, he didn't disagree. They actually can't disagree because they don't have free will. They don't have libertarian free will, so they have to do those things. So, and I find that that's a lot of comfort for people there. One student said, you know, if determinism isn't true, that means you're better than me. And I got to tell you, Hank, I was floored. I was shocked. That thought would never have occurred to me in a million years. But he thought that, okay, I've made a mess of my life and I haven't, you know, I've hurt my family and I've done all these bad things, and I can't then over all those things say, well, I couldn't have done otherwise. Glory to God.
Yeah, so there's sort of an overarching question here, and I suppose that is, you have learned to do this in the university setting, and I'm sure in many other settings as well, in the church setting, amongst friends that are on the opposite side of the issue that we're talking about from you, you've learned the art and skill of being collegial in those situations. In other words, reaching rather than repelling, having dialogue rather than just simply writing someone off.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. We cannot, and this is one of my big things that I try to teach our students, because we have sometimes we have some pretty hot-headed young apologists coming in, and I'm trying to teach them not to fight over peripheral doctrines. It's okay to argue about them nicely, collegially, and in a friendly way, but let's not get divisive over that kind of thing. I'm getting far off afield, but let me just say that, yes, we have to be nice to people, but it does come down, the theodicy that I present does come down, that God wanted to create beings with a libertarian free will. And because that's the only kind of free will that makes any sense. And I'd even point out to you, I did an article, one of my favorite articles that I did for the Christian Research Journal was entitled Sci-Fi Free Will and the Problem of Evil.
Oh, yeah.
And I just went through and showed how sci-fi authors always conclude, regardless of the amount of suffering that comes into the world, that humans are better off having free will. And because, I mean, we can't even conceive what it would be like not to have free will. And so I think that the free will argument is a lot of what I'm presenting.
Yeah, I think in that article, if I recall, you also point out that in a real world, people have to be responsible because natural law, at the end of the day, is pretty predictable.
Yeah, if natural laws must work in regular ways if our actions are going to mean anything at all. And I, you know, people ask me about Hurricane Katrina, and why did God allow Hurricane Katrina to destroy New Orleans? And I'll say, well, let's think about it for a minute. We built a city below sea level, and we built it with walls that we knew for a fact could not withstand a hurricane beyond Category 3, when Hurricane Categories 4 and 5 were a regular part of our existence. In other words, it wasn't that we thought that hurricanes never went over Category 3, and then one day we went, oh my gosh, they go to Category 5. That's not what happened. And so we built a city below sea level with protections that we knew were inadequate to stop threats that were a regular part of our experience. And here's what Solomon says: when a man's folly brings his way to ruin, his heart rages against the Lord. And natural laws have to work in regular ways if our actions are going to mean anything at all. Or back to your first comment, otherwise we're in a cartoon world.
One of Hank's favorite films of the year was Becoming Truly Human. And the podcast with director Nathan Jacobs did not disappoint. Here's a clip of their conversation.
I want to go back to something that you were talking about earlier, although there's a richness that I'd like to explore based on what you just said that probably needs to be communicated to our audience as well. But I want to go back to something that you said sort of in passing with respect to your remarks on soteriology. You said Catholic Protestants, they sort of hold this, whereas the Eastern Fathers or Eastern Orthodoxy hold, and then you started elaborating. But that in itself, I think, is something that needs to be expanded upon, because for most people, when they think of Eastern Orthodoxy, they think that the similarities between Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism are almost such that they're one and the same. One is just a derivation of the other. One is just slightly tweaking the other. But you sort of pointed out when you're talking about soteriology that in many cases, the Western Church, the Roman Catholics, and the Protestants have a whole lot more in common than, let's say, Catholics and Orthodox.
Yeah. Well, this is something my mom, who is still getting accustomed to the idea that I'm Eastern Orthodox, it's entirely foreign to her. And, every now and then we have these conversations where she's trying to get her head around what's happened to her son. And one of the things that I've occasionally tried to explain to her is that, you know, her Lutheranism is far closer to Roman Catholicism than my Orthodoxy is, which of course is something no German Lutheran ever wants to hear. one of the things that I think was so remarkable to sort of begin to unpack this was as I began to see that central to what became so definitive in the medieval period and beyond in terms of Western thought was the merit and demerit system of the West. There's this judicial tendency that's there in the West, and we see it very early. You can already see it in contrast, such as the way Tertullian talks about, he'll talk about in very judicial terms about demonic exacting of certain debts, for example, which contrasts very starkly with the way the Eastern writers talk. But what was very sort of formative in the systematizing of it was Augustine's notion of the order of loves. So Augustine of Hippo, as he developed this concept of the order of loves, he essentially comes to realize that we have various affections, right? I can have affections for God, I can have affections for man, I can have affections for animals, or for pizza, for that matter. And he recognized that in each of us, the order or the hierarchy of those affections can vary. So, for example, we talk of people who are dog lovers. And when we say that, the reason that we call them dog lovers rather than philanthropists is because it appears that they may well love dogs more than they love humans in some cases. And then there are other of us who have very low affection for dogs. You know, we might think that they smell or they're slobbery or whatever. We almost have a disdain for them. And so Augustine came to realize that there's these various sort of priorities that we can have in our affections. And crucial to Augustine's thinking when he's navigating the question of what does it mean that when we talk about God being just or man being just or us being made just, the Latin semantic range for justice, justitia, had a very limited semantic range, which meant very precisely to render to each what is due. And that began to provide a framework for interpreting how does a just person do just deeds. And Augustine came to see that, well, a just person's affections, somebody who renders to each what is due, should render to each thing in creation the appropriate amount of affection it's due. So if in the hierarchy of goods, angels are superior to humans and humans are superior to dogs and God is above all, our affections should reflect that. We should have affection for God and then angels and then man and then dogs. And then we would have just orders of loves or orders of affections. And because Augustine began to talk about the affections from which our deeds proceed, this created the difference between an external character of an act and the internal character of an act. And this is what provides the framework for saying, well, you might have two people do the same deed. For example, someone gives to a homeless person food. Another person gives to a homeless person food. Well, is that deed good or is it not? Well, by distinguishing the internal character from the external character, Augustine can say, well, both deeds line up with the moral law, what we ought to do, but one might be just and one might be unjust. One might be done for the mere love of self and the fact that it makes me feel good. The other might be done out of love for God above all else. And so you might have one person do that way in a way that is just and meritorious before God, and another person who does that deed in a way that is demeritorious toward God. It is not just, even though externally they're the same type of act. And this sort of way of looking at deeds is what sets up the entire medieval system for talking about the idea that Adam has a special grace called original righteousness that enables him to perform deeds out of true love for God, and that in the fall, that grace is cast off, and that we are all born with inverted order of loves and thus bound by necessity to sin. Now, the necessity to sin is not that we have to commit adultery and steal and things like that. The necessity to sin is that our affections are jumbled. They're not just. And so even when we do deeds in accord with the moral law, they're not meritorious before God. This is why prevenient grace, a special assistance, is needed in order to correct the order of loves, or at least make it possible for the order of loves us to do deeds out of proper, just affections, and therefore begin to perform meritorious deeds. And this becomes the basis for the medieval soteriology that then sort of gives way later to indulgences and the question of surpluses of merits that saints might have and perhaps the church can redistribute and so on. But what we find is that in the Reformation, this entire notion of the order of loves, prevenient grace, the necessity of sin, and those sorts of things isn't cast off. That remains in full in the discussions that Luther and Calvin and others are having. What we find is that dispute is just a question of whose merits, and you know, how are these merits being shuffled around? And of course, the revolutionary thing that Luther is introducing is the question that perhaps the deeds, even when they're done in grace, are not meritorious, and perhaps what we really need is the merits of Christ, who alone was able to do fully meritorious deeds. Maybe we need his merits imputed to us and our demerits imputed to him on the cross, and that ultimately prevenient grace does not enable us to do meritorious deeds, but to believe unto salvation rather than the Catholic framework in which the fixing of affections permits us or enables us to do meritorious deeds. That entire framework is very alien to the Christian East. As I've put it, and I put it in the film, Becoming Truly Human, the East, the primary concern, the main enemy we face is death and corruption. And we see this come through very clearly in these early disputes, specifically with folks like Athanasius, where what we see happen is Arius comes along and suggests that the Son of God is a creature. There was a time where it was just God, and then he decided to create a son. And Athanasius sees heresy. Athanasius, when he hears Arius's heresy, what he suggests is, he says, you know, Arius, if you're correct, the Son of God can be of no help to us. And the reason is because if he's a creature, then he is corruptible just like we are. He is mutable just like we are. He is not necessarily good, but he could be churned morally, and so on and so forth. And he goes through all these entailments. And what comes through in that discussion is that Athanasius is crystal clear about the fact that what the gospel offers us is that we are a dying species. As creatures, we are susceptible to corruption. In the fall, that corruptibility became actual corruption. And what the incarnation offers to us is the immortal life of God reentering our species and offering the possibility of us putting off corruption for incorruption, as St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15. It is all about remedying death and taking in life. There is not a merit-demerit system at work here. And that is a world of a difference between how the Christian faith is looked at and what the gospel of Jesus Christ is really offering to us.
You know, you have communicated so many things that are so rich and need so much expansion. And one of those things has to do with the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. We find that tree of life again in the New Jerusalem, where the angel showing John the river of the water of life as clear as crystal flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And on the other side of the river stood the tree of life bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations, and so forth. So the tree of life that we see in Eden reappears in the eternal garden. But I think what needs to be cashed out for Christians today is that Adam and Eve needed to eat from the tree of life. They were then barred from eating from the tree of life. And with the restoration, with the unfolding plan of redemption, that tree of life comes into play again. And when we embrace Christ, we can eat from the tree of life. In other words, we can experience deification. We can experience the graces that allow us to become by grace what God is by nature. And so we don't just have to wait for something that we're going to experience in the hereafter. We don't have to wait for something that we're going to experience when Jesus appears a second time. We can experience that divine life now. So Christ not only saves us by his death, he saves us, as Galatians 2 makes clear, he saves us into his life. And that makes the Christian experience so rich and powerful and transcendent right now, right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I think is so remarkable, I remember asking once, how often does God the Father do something directly in the Bible? And I of course mean God is of course active throughout all of history, but I mean where the agent we see show up directly acting is God the Father. And it is very difficult to find passages where God acts directly as opposed to through his Son, through his Spirit, through an angel, through a prophet, and so on. And of course, it's significant what those are. For example, they are things like speaking at the baptism of Christ and declaring him to be his son, speaking at the transfiguration, for example, speaking creation into being. And yet what we begin to see is that God chooses not to act through supernatural lightning bolts that appear between things in creation, but God chooses to always act in and through the things he creates, or in the case of the Son and the Spirit, in and through the second and third persons of the Trinity. These become the agents through which God is acting. But I think that's so significant because what we begin to see is this pattern throughout history prior to the incarnation, where God acts and gives life through a tree. He speaks through prophets. He speaks through angels. He heals leprosy through waterbeds. And even in the incarnation, it's not as if what we see is the divine nature jumping over the human nature in order to, in order to heal a person, but rather he heals through his own flesh. Power goes out to him through his garments. He uses mud, whatever it may be. And we see this pattern where God is so insistent on supplying his life and his healing and his acts in and through the creation. So it should be no surprise to us that we discover that he gives us life through things such as sacraments, such as the washing of baptism and being baptized into Christ, receiving the Holy Spirit through the oil of chrismation, through the Eucharist, and that we again see this tree, as you pointed out, Hank, appearing in the book of Revelation. That seems to be the pattern, that God gives his life, not waiting for us to be disembodied and getting rid of this evil flesh as if we are Gnostics, but rather that the whole of creation begins to participate in that life, and we see the conduits for that life coming to us in the gifts, the sacraments, and ultimately that we ourselves are supposed to be conduits for that life to things beyond ourselves.
What's really interesting to me is that I first encountered all of this as a result of the teachings of Watchman Nee, and I embraced those teachings when I went to China, and I saw people who didn't have a whole lot of theological acumen, but they had this life, and it actually ended up changing the moniker for our ministry from simply saying we do what we do because truth matters to saying we do what we do because life and truth matter. So in the teachings of Watchman Nee and Witness Lee, you had this idea of deification that seems to be absent on the whole within modern-day Christianity in general. Even within Orthodoxy, I don't think that people fully grasp the jewel that they have. That jewel has been ensconced in a box and then protected by another box, and pretty soon we lose touch with the jewel by which, when we partake of the Eucharist, when we partake of the Lord's table or of Mass, we are partaking of something that allows us, that gives us a grace that allows us to be a partaker in the divine nature, and that's a game changer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the first place I began to really encounter deification, it was actually prior to reading the Eastern Church Fathers, but I didn't quite realize what I had stumbled on until I read Athanasius and then Basil and on from there.
The next clip is with Hank's close friend, Chris Wilde, where they discuss the crucial conversation between Hank and their mutual friend, Elijah, that eventually led to CRI adapting the moniker of the ministry from Because Truth Matters to Because Life and Truth Matter.
You and I have a mutual friend. In fact, I would not know him if it were not for you. He's become very, very significant in my life. I won't identify him except for by his first name. His name is Elijah. And I remember being in Southern California with him and handing him a bracelet that had our ministry moniker on it, Because Truth Matters. And he had become a friend of mine, someone that I highly respected in the recovery. In fact, he had been a prophetic voice to me in many ways, someone that said exactly the right thing to me at exactly the right time, such that I could only identify this as coming from the Lord. And so he had great credibility with me, but I handed him that bracelet as a gift as we were walking to a dinner. And he handed it directly back to me and said, "Well, I think life matters more." That was one of the most awkward experiences I have ever had, because here I'm walking with a friend, and I had been, as it were, dissed by that friend. I gave him a gift, he handed it back, and I felt terrible. And I remember the rest of that meal was a very awkward time. I tried to engage, but I mean, I was just quenched in the spirit. And I kept thinking to myself, how can life matter more? Maybe it matters as much. Maybe I can grant that, but how can it matter more? But that became a turning point in my life, a seminal point in my life. In fact, not just a seminal point in my life, but it became a seminal point in the life of the ministry of the Christian Research Institute, such that we changed the ministry moniker from Truth Matters to We Do What We Do Because Life and Truth Matter. And I suppose some of the early conversations that I had with you as we traveled, not just to China, but eventually all over the world, some of those conversations were very instructional to me as well. You were talking about the fact that Christ not only came to save us by his death, but to save us into his life. That's biblical.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If I could, maybe I'll circle back to a brief mention of yours in the beginning there, when you talked about this matter of deification, how we understand that. And I even then, Hank, I think in 2003 or 4, when we first started talking about that, the matter of deification was almost completely off the table in evangelical circles. It was very, very infrequently, if ever spoken about, and usually if it was in a pejorative sense. And I think, no doubt, probably due to the influence of groups like the Mormons, who have an understanding that is not biblical, and it comes nowhere near what we're talking about. But, you know, you mentioned Athanasius, who many considers the father of orthodoxy because of his influence at the early councils on matters such as the nature, the two natures of Christ, and things like that. But it was he who uttered that famous, what now has become known, I think, as the Athanasius aphorism: "God became man in order to make man God." And Witness Lee said that frequently. However, I think in almost every instance, either implicit or explicit, and usually explicit, he added a qualifier: in life and nature, but not in the Godhead. That goes farther than even the fully orthodox Athanasius went, right? So God became man in order to make man God, or so that man might become God, in life and nature, but not in the Godhead. And in both cases, in both of those two adjectives, life and nature, I think they're used as adjectives there, they're biblical. Romans 5:10 was the verse you quoted. You know, we're saved, we're justified in his death, but we're saved much more. It says we shall be saved in his life. And in 2 Peter 1:4, that he says we are partakers of the divine nature. So both Watchman Nee and Witness Lee put those two together: life and nature. We're born again, right? We're born, that means we receive another life. That's what it is to be born. And then in this case, we receive a divine life. And with that life comes a divine nature. But that just completely eliminates, by saying it that way, in life and nature, but not in the Godhead, that precludes any possibility that we're talking about taking on God's non-communicable attributes. We'll never be objects of worship. We're not, you know, we're not omnipresent, omniscient, or what's the third?
Omnipotent.
Omnipotent, right, yeah. We should probably start with that.
And there's many more.
Yeah.
We're not ineffable.
Right. Those, yeah. those are attributes we'll never participate in, but in life and nature. And, you know, I was thinking, we used to talk a lot about things we'd experienced in those days when we were in China and meeting those believers who we'd seen, you know, that had suffered so much more than we've ever suffered, regardless of the bad things that people would say about us and wrong things. But people, as you said, whose lives had been dramatically affected, years of imprisonment, separation from their family, beatings, torture, even death, you know. And I think the thing that you would come away with, and I think you said this to me at one point, I'll try to get it right, but, you know, for many of us who have a, you know, our appreciation of Christ and the gospel may only be at the stage where we think our job is to point people to Him. And that's true. I'm not minimizing that. Yeah, we do have that obligation to point people to Him. But really, what the kind of Christian life and salvation that the Bible presents to us is not one where we're merely pointing people to Christ, but it's where we are here expressing Him, manifesting Him, exhibiting Him. Those are all biblical concepts, right? And that's what we would see, meeting and talking to these people. And it just, boy, it just changes your outlook on everything, doesn't it?
This last conversation with Donald Fairbairn is truly illuminating and delves into how we as Christians can find true union with God.
One of my favorite Eastern Orthodox quotes is one by Vladimir Lossky, where he said, following the fall, the whole history of the Christian church is it's a history of shipwreck awaiting rescue. And then he said, the port of salvation is not the goal. It is for the shipwreck to continue on a journey whose sole goal is union with God. And in some sense, that's what you seem to be underscoring in a very poignant, profound way in your book, Life in the Trinity.
Yes, it is. It is certainly the case that in any individual believer's understanding of Christianity or any group's understanding of Christianity, it's incomplete. It's fallen. There's a Russian expression that sounds better in Russian than it does in English, but it translates as, we cannot know perfect truth perfectly. The truth is perfect, and it's perfect in its comprehensiveness as well as its absoluteness. But our grasp of it is limited, it's imperfect, it's still growing. In a sense, we are shipwrecked, and we're grasping on to that plank from the ship, which is the truth that we're hanging on to for salvation. But we don't see yet what the whole ship looks like.
And we're on our way to union with God. You've written a lot in your books about deification and theosis. And many people in the Western world, the evangelical Christian world, are not familiar with those terms.
Yes, I think that a lot of the typical Western dislike of the word deification or theosis or union with God is that we equate that with works salvation. And as Protestants, of course, we have our antennae up against anything that might smack of works salvation. But I think that if we recognize that a union with God that has been established as a relationship, that is going to lead to a development of that relationship. If we see union just in terms of qualities, for example, acquiring divine qualities or something like that, then you might think of it in terms of our works or our action being primary. But if you think of union in terms of communion, in terms of fellowship, in terms of relationship, then you recognize God has to give that to us. But then we, through the Holy Spirit, have to work out the implications of that. And that progress toward fuller union with God is an unveiling of a relationship that has already been established by God and by God alone at the beginning of salvation. And so I don't think that our dislike for the idea of union with God or even progressive union with God is necessarily justified. I think we need to recognize that it starts with the establishment of a relationship and then develops into an unfolding of the implications of that relationship.
You know, I'm watching you speak so eloquently in this podcast, and I'm thinking about the fact that all of us have maladies. I have mental cell lymphoma, but you've struggled with the malady of being deaf. I heard you say in one lecture I heard some time ago that you're completely deaf in one ear and 90% deaf in the other ear, and yet there seems to be a benefit in that. In other words, God uses all things for good to those who love him and are the called according to his purposes. So even in that particular liability, as some would see it, you've developed a way of synthesizing thought.
Yes, and it is ironic, I suppose, and it is like the Lord to do something like this, that a great deal of my ministry grows directly out of my deafness. Because of my deafness, in order to understand what people say, I have to very quickly put together bits and pieces of information. So I don't ever hear whole words, for example. I may hear the vowels. I might or might not be able to lip read the consonants. I have to go by the context. I have to go by the body language. And I have to try to put all of that together in order to understand what somebody is saying. And so because of that, I have an extraordinary amount of practice at synthetic reasoning. My whole life, I have been reasoning things together in order to try to understand what people are saying. We didn't even know that I was deaf in one ear until I was 6 years old.
Oh.
Because I wasn't slow learning to talk. There were none of the warning signs that normally show up to mark out a hearing impairment. But it was because I developed this ability to put things together synthetically that has also given me the gift of being able to recognize connections between concepts, between aspects of Christian theology that other people might not see, to see commonality beyond differences of terms where other people might just say the words are different, therefore the substance must be different as well. And a great deal of my ministry has to do with helping different groups of Christians to go deeper, but also to recognize that there may be more commonality than we realize. And I think that my deafness and all of the difficulties in communication that have gone along with that have been part of the way the Lord has prepared me for that ministry that he had for me.
Both of us happen to love golf as well. You walked into my office and immediately identified the 12th hole at Augusta National. Has your deafness helped your golf game?
Well, not that I know of. I have to go by feel.
It's not necessarily unfair advantage.
No, I am a pretty good recreational golfer, but nothing special. I have to go by feel rather than by sound, because I can't tell the difference between the sound of a good shot and a bad shot. But I really can't say that I'm a better golfer than I would be if my hearing were better.
You know, I want to get back to something that you, less personal and a little more theological, but, you know, I just wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. And in that book, I talk about the Muslim view of the Trinity. Muslims obviously hold to a Unitarian view of God. And what I've written about is how that view is really a defective view, because a Unitarian God, independent of the universe, cannot exercise the attribute of love. And yet God has for all eternity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, the persons of the Trinity, identity formed and completed on the basis of relationships within the Trinity, have had eternally a love relationship. And maybe in a more expansive sense, the beauty of it is for a Christian, as opposed to the Muslim view, we can be brought into that fellowship. I mean, that's the essence of your book.
Yeah. Yes, I agree completely. And in fact, one of the things that I say in my book, Life in the Trinity, is that Islam is not simply prescribing a different means to salvation. Islam is prescribing a different kind of salvation altogether. Or to say that differently, Christianity offers a kind of salvation that is not even on offer in Islam or in any other religion. Because Christian salvation is fundamentally the sharing in a relationship. Part of the problem that we have as evangelicals is that we tend to think of salvation only in terms of what I call the how question. How do I get saved? What has to happen in order for me to be saved? What is the means of salvation? But we don't really think as much about what heaven actually is or what salvation actually is. And to fill out that understanding, I like to tell people that Christ is not merely the means to salvation. He is also the content of salvation. Salvation is fellowship with Christ. Salvation is Christ. And he's also the locus of salvation. He's the place where salvation happens. It is in the person of Christ, Paul says in Romans 3, that the atonement happens. It is in the person of Christ that salvation happens. We are saved when we are in Christ, and in Christ or in him is Paul's favorite expression on virtually every page of Paul's letters. So Christianity is not simply saying whatever you think of as heaven, the way you get that is by Christ. It's a very particular understanding of what salvation is that is connected to the relationship between the persons of the Trinity. And a God who is not a God of fellowship, a God of persons in fellowship, can't even offer, even if he existed, he couldn't even offer that kind of salvation.
This is perhaps an overstatement, and it's often talked about in the Eastern Church. You have the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the mystery that causes you to tremble and yet attracts you. It's a church in which many theological constructs are not explained, but experienced. In the Western Church, there's this sense of snarling logicality. We have to explain everything. Now, obviously, that's an overstatement. Someone like yourself, having studied the patristics, would know that that is an overstatement. But I want perhaps you to give us a little balance between the Eastern Church and the Western Church, the Eastern Church thinking about things in the sense of mysteries that cannot be explained, the Western Church wanting to explain things with precision language.
Okay. I think a good way to answer that great question would be to talk about the way I discuss this very idea with Westerners versus the way I talk about it with Easterners. One of the things that I sometimes say to my Western students is to ask the question, are you saved by faith in Christ? Or are you saved by faith in the doctrine of justification by faith? And when I ask that question, what I'm getting at is that the doctrines are not the focus of our faith. They point to God who alone can save us, to Christ who alone can save us. We don't believe, technically, we don't believe in the doctrine of justification by faith. We believe that that doctrine is true because it points to the fact that Christ alone can save us. So I talk about this kind of thing with Westerners and help in order to help them recognize that doctrines are not the be-all and end-all of our faith. They are pointers to God. And our focus ultimately needs to be not just on the concepts, but on God. So that's a way of trying to get Westerners to move from the realm of definitions and distinctions a little closer to the realm of experience of God. When I'm having the same kind of conversation with Easterners, with Russians or Ukrainians or Greek students of mine, I will tell a story about a student of mine from rural Russia who told me at the end of our discussion of the Trinity, and we spent about 20 hours in class on the Trinity, And this student told me, you are not supposed to understand the Trinity. You're just supposed to believe it. And everything that you've done these last 20 hours has been worthless. He told me this in class. Now, as you can imagine, that wasn't the high point of my teaching career. But it raised a very important point. A lot of Christians, especially Eastern Christians, are afraid that if they get God figured out too much, they won't find him to be worth worshiping. And my comment, after I tell the story and after we unpack that idea, my comment to these students is always, don't worry. You're never going to figure God out enough that you find him not worth worshiping. In fact, the more you seek to understand, the more you realize how vastly beyond your comprehension God is. So I'm trying to help Westerners move from focus on the doctrines to a more direct focus on God. But I'm also trying to help Easterners probe the mystery of God more deeply, recognizing that they're never going to get to the bottom, and that they will appreciate God all the more they seek to fathom the mystery of God.
And I think this is something that ought to be explained not only from our temporal circumstance, but from the eternal circumstance, because even in eternity, we will never come to an end of appreciating or learning about the ineffable God that saved us by his grace.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. One of the criticisms that Eastern Christians make of Western Christians is that our understanding of paradise, the initial paradise, and our understanding of eternity are too static. And I think that that criticism is fair, because we don't mean to say that there was no room for growth in Eden before the fall. And we certainly don't mean to say that there will be no room for continued growth in eternity for believers as well. But if you go back to the central focus on relationship, at creation, God gave Adam and Eve fellowship with himself. That relationship was there. There was room to develop it, room for it to grow, room to explore the implications of it, but the relationship was there. And in the same way, for believers, that relationship is there now. But both in this life and in eternity, there will be continued room to explore that, to develop that, to grow in that relationship. So we can speak of a genuine relationship while still recognizing that there's room for it to grow.
Room to grow seems to be something that we ought to cash out a little bit for people, because I fear all too often that the Christian faith has become transactional. It's believe certain dogmas, and then you're going to get a card that gets you into heaven and keeps you out of hell, as opposed to transformational. Christ not only saves us by his death, but he saves us into his life so that we can experience the vine, the engrafted life of Christ.
Yes, and I think the word transactional is a very good word to use of the way we often misconstrue what's going on in Christian life. I affirm a strongly substitutionary aspect to the atonement, but sometimes we can take the idea of substitution so far that we turn it into nothing but a transaction. Christ took upon himself our sin so that we could receive his righteousness. That's fair as a summary as far as that goes. But there's more going on than that, because ultimately what's going on, as Paul says in Romans 6, is that we are buried with him, we die with him, and we rise with him. And baptism represents that burial and that rebirth. And so there is more going on than simply, he took this and I get this. In addition to that, or more deeply than that, what's going on is that as he goes through, as he went through death and resurrection, when we are united to him by the presence of the Holy Spirit within us, we too, in a sense, go through that as well. Cyril of Jerusalem, a 4th century church father, describing baptism, says that we go through the death symbolically, but we receive the life, the salvation, literally. He went through death and resurrection, so that as we are united to him, we, in a sense, die and rise again. And so that union with Christ leads to a new life, which, of course, has to be developed. We have to grow. We have to explore the implications of that new life. And so to look at it simply as a transaction is to miss, I think, the deeper mystery, if you will, of what is happening, and therefore the depths of what motivates us in Christian life.
We hope you enjoyed this small sample of the incredibly edifying conversations taking place on the Hank Unplugged podcast. If you'd like to listen to more of any of these episodes, you can find them archived on iTunes, equip.org, or wherever else you consume your favorite podcasts. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, it would be a great help to our team at the Christian Research Institute if you could head to iTunes and leave us a review. This small act takes less than 30 seconds and goes a long way towards helping us achieve our goal of reaching and uplifting people around the world with information and well-reasoned answers that equip them to represent the essentials of the historic Christian faith. Thanks again for listening to this special edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We'll see you next time.